Good morning, everyone.
I was going to pick up a small bug myself. Not COVID, just a cold, I think. So we'll push through this. Today is voting day, so if you haven't, I encourage you to go out and do that. I want to continue talking today about combined nucleosynthesis and how we measure the abundances of the light isotopes in order to constrain what happened in the first few minutes when they were made, and that is our best measurement of the baryon density. All right. So remember, we have these three pillars of the hot Big Bang. The universe is expanding. As it expands, the relic radiation field that we detect in the microwave background cools off, just as 1 plus Z. So if it's 3 degrees now, it reaches 1,000. It was 3,000 degrees Kelvin, and that's when surface of blast scattering was made. And in between there, in the first few minutes, we have Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which give us the abundances of light isotopes, helium-4, helium-3, deuterium, and lithium-7. So the program is to go out and measure the abundances of these things in real objects, try to relate that back to the primordial abundance, and then hopefully they all line up at a value consistent with a single baryon density. So we went through this last time. You have to solve this reaction chain. So this is the theory side. You start out with neutrons and protons in equilibrium. As the universe cools, neutrons weigh more than protons, so while they're still in thermal equilibrium, you get relatively more protons, labeled H here, for things that will become hydrogen atoms, than neutrons, just because of that difference in the energy. And then at some point they freeze out. The universe has expanded too much for those things to remain in thermal equilibrium, at which point neutrons start to decay. Free neutrons decay with a half-life of around 10 minutes. And so that sets the ratio of protons to neutrons when nucleosynthesis happened. The neutrons basically get gobbled up into deuterium, and then the deuterium gets gobbled up into helium. So there's the helium abundance. There's a deuterium abundance, and then you get traces of all these other things. The essential one being lithium-7 that we can measure in old stars, as old as this. And some of that started as beryllium, most of it, in fact, but beryllium-7 is itself unstable with a half-life of months. So for all intents and purposes, it becomes primordial lithium. All right, so that's what's happening in time. In terms of density, so now omega baryon are really the photon to proton ratio, but we know the number density of photons really well from the microwave background observations. So for all practical purposes, this is the density of baryons, normal matter. And in terms of the critical density, one gets a baryon density around 4 or 5% where all these things cross. That is to say, you predict this variation for the abundance of deuterium as the baryon density increases. The more baryons, the more effective the uptake of deuterium into helium-4 is, and so the abundance of primordial deuterium, how much is left over from this process, declines the higher omega baryon is, more goes into helium. And so we saw this last time, the program for helium is to identify low metallicity galaxies observe their H2 region spectra, and there's a little, where's the helium line? There it is. A little helium line there. And if you have really good data, you can zoom in on these and you can see a whole forest of other lines and things that are there. So you need really high quality data, which is one reason this is mostly done on nearby galaxies. Of course, you'd really like to go back and observe this closer to the Big Bang, right, when it first happened, before stars had time to pollute any. And so what's done is to simultaneously measure the oxygen abundance and the helium abundance in H2 regions like this, and then try to infer what the stellar contribution of helium is from the oxygen contribution. That is to say, oxygen is only made inside stars, started out at zero primordially, and as stars pollute the interstellar medium with the nucleus synthesis products released by supernovae, then the oxygen abundance goes up. Along with it, the helium abundance goes up, so the difference between here and there is presumptively the contribution of stars, which is not much, right? That slope is very flat, and so the vast majority of the helium is primordial, and it's really hard to measure this slope. So you see there's a whole big splatter of points. That's good, because everything is giving you a helium fraction of a quarter, which is basically what we expect from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. But to actually use the helium abundance to constrain the baryon density, we need to get back to the primordial value, and so one does this line-fitting exercise. And it's not easy. You would think fitting a straight line is straightforward, and it's not. Basically, all these data in the middle, the big error bars, do nothing. The slope is almost entirely dominated by this one point near the inner zero oxygen abundance and this one point at high oxygen abundance with very small error bars. Basically, a chi-square fitter will always drive things through the error bars. So you could just delete the rest of that data and you would just get almost exactly the same answer. Linear fits basically are very sensitive. The slopes of the linear fits are very sensitive to the most extremal cases that have small errors. So I think this is good evidence that the basic picture is sound, that the primordial helium abundance is around a quarter as expected, but to use it as a baryometer, to actually infer the baryon density from this, you need to measure the third digit, and for this you could have just observed that one galaxy and the rest don't matter. People have done different permutations of this and they all get similar answers, but it's really hard to get that third place of decimals right, which is what one needs to turn in this into a good constraint on that. All this really says is that, yeah, that's what happened. All right, so a more precise baryometer is deuterium. And here deuterium is measured in absorption along the line of sight to distance quasars. So on the one hand, that's good. This is something we can observe closer to the Big Bang at redshifts 3, 4, 6, when the universe was still young, and so there hadn't been a lot of time to pollute the clouds. But it's also a little tricky to do observationally. So here's the basic setup. We're over here observing some distant quasar, and along the line of sight from that quasar, there are a bunch of little Lyman alpha forest clouds. So this is the spectrum of that quasar. And you see the at the redshift of the quasar, there's Lyman alpha. That's the 2-to-1 transition in hydrogen. And that gobbles up all the UV photons. Basically, if there's any neutral hydrogen gas between us and them, it'll get gobbled up. And so that red line is what we think the intrinsic spectrum radiated by the quasar is. And then there's a whole lot of absorption imprinted on it. from intervening clouds.
So you're looking along the line of sight, they're all little tiny column density clouds. This is called the Lyman Alpha Forest. So this is not noise. It looks like noise, but that's actually all signal. Those are all real absorbers at different redshifts along the line of sight. And so, because they're all at different distances, they have different redshifts, and so the same Lyman Alpha line shows up in many places. So the universe is just full of these tiny neutral hydrogen clouds, and they are tiny because Lyman Alpha is such a good absorber. You only need a column density of hydrogen of order 10 to the 15 atoms per square centimeter, which is a tiny, tiny, tiny number. Think of a mole, it's like 10 to the 23, right? 10 to the 50, there's just not much out there. So Lyman Alpha is very good at showing up. Oh, there's a little puff of gas there. Oh, there's a little puff of gas there. And you get this forest. What you don't see very often is the Gunn-Peterson trough. Gunn and Peterson a long time ago realized that if the intergalactic medium is neutral, is there's a lot of just atomic hydrogen around, then Lyman Alpha from that will gobble it up. And so if there was a lot of neutral gas in the intergalactic medium, this would be a broad trough rather than discrete lines, because then you would have absorption at different redshifts continuously throughout this intergalactic medium. You don't see that. We have detected it finally. You had to get up above redshift 6 to do it, but lower than that, you don't see that. So after redshift 6, the entire intergalactic medium where most of the baryons still reside has been reionized. So it was completely ionized to begin with. At recombination, it became neutral when you had a neutral gas, and then at some later time, there were enough UV photons produced by galaxies and quasars to reionize the entire intergalactic medium. And you're just left over with these discrete clouds rather than a broad trough that you would get from a continuous medium absorbing as things got redshifted. Now, this has been observed at redshifts higher than 6. Took a long, long time to do that. And so we're starting to constrain the history of reionization. Basically, when did those UV photons flood back out and ionize the intergalactic medium? And all what we know very well so far is that that process was done by redshift 6. We don't really know empirically where it began ahead of that, but at least redshift 9 and maybe as high as 20, something like that. So that's what the data look like. Now, every once in a while, you will get a damped Lyman Alpha forest where the column density is high. So this is something like actually going through the disk of a galaxy. Whether it's not just a little tiny intergalactic cloud there, but a relatively large bit of stuff. And so those damped Lyman Alpha forests, you zoom in on that, and you get a line profile like this. And it's completely black at normal hydrogen. So there's so much absorption that basically nothing gets through in that range. Right? Hydrogen gobbles up all those Lyman Alpha photons. In this case, you can see it's redshifted just a little bit from the emitted piece, and the profiles of Lyman Alpha itself are usually asymmetric because the absorption happens as soon as it goes out along its line of sight. Okay, so there's this broad trough that's due to regular hydrogen. When you have this much absorption, you can also see a deuterium line, that same Lyman Alpha line, the 2-to-1 transition, is shifted a tiny bit energetically because the structure of a deuterium atom is not quite the same as a hydrogen atom. I mean, it looks the same, right? You have all the same energy levels, but because the mass of the nucleus is different, where those levels are shifted slightly. So right on the shoulder of this absorption is deuterium. And so this is the same line, Lyman Alpha 2-to-1 transition,
but shifted just a little bit energetically.
So now you can measure the ratio of deuterium to hydrogen, which is what we're trying to do here, to get a constraint on what the deuterium abundance was at this time. And presumably, it is indistinguishably close to primordial, that this stuff hasn't been polluted yet. It's just out in the intergalactic medium. It's all good. But do you see any challenges to doing that? Right. It's going to be easy to compare that line to that line, because that's what you got to do. So here's another example. And again, this is in principle good, because the deuterium abundance is very sensitive to the baryon density. There's a big variation here. But there are observational, so that is good for that. It's also good for the fact that you would not expect there to be much stellar pollution as of yet. The trick, well, there are several tricks in this, but one is, how do you know what the intrinsic spectrum of the quasar is? So these are absorption lines. You need to measure their equivalent widths relative to the intrinsic flux. And it's actually easy to get that wrong. Right? There's flux across here and here, and these lines have different shapes. And just that difference in shape will make a difference to your deuterium abundance when it's this tiny weak line compared to the strong line. So that's one of the systematics I worry about a lot, is how do we set the continuum? But people have done this. So what you have here are a couple of plots of the measurements of the deuterium abundance in these high redshift sight lines to quasars. So this is the log of the number of deuterium to hydrogen atoms, and you can see it's tiny, right? 10^-4.5, something. And here are some different measured systems. I'm doing it again over here, but now you're plotting against column density. And on this axis is what the corresponding primordial baryon density is. It'll make a BH squared, right? So this used to be 0.019, and now it's all shifted down here. So there was some systematic error, or else we've introduced a new systematic error to get these points moved down. They used to be all up at the top. But the other thing that's worth checking here is, does your answer depend on the oxygen abundance? Maybe there has been some pollution, or deuterium tends to get destroyed in nucleosynthesis, so what's going on there? But there's no obvious trend with the oxygen abundance in the same system, so presumably this is close enough to primordial that we can just draw a straight line here, not fit a slope. And here there's also, it's plotted against what is the column density. Again, logarithmic, it's just how many atoms are there in the line of sight that the photons have to propagate through. And again, there's no trend here, and one reason this is interesting is you just look at this, right? These are all very low column density things, that's a very high column density thing. Things get pretty nonlinear there when the thing is strong, so does it depend on that column density? And historically, there were indications that it might. That seems to have gone away, right? You don't see any clear trends there. So we think this is the primordial baryon density, and that deuterium gives you this density of baryons. And notice that the deuterium abundance goes down as the abundance goes up, so these axes go in different directions. This is a lot of deuterium, that's a little. This is a lot of baryons, that's a little. But the range is small because this is a fairly sensitive indicator. The other thing I worry about systematically is this curve of growth. This is usually what you see in the context of stellar atmospheres and analyzing the abundances of the elements in atmospheres of stars, which is this is for lithium. But just a more general comment now, the equivalent width, how much absorption you get, is this funny function of the column density. So that applies here as well. The column density of this is really high. The column density of deuterium is really weak. So weak lines are what you want to measure abundances with, because this curve of growth is linear. That is, the equivalent width, how much of the continuum gets absorbed, grows linearly with the column density. You basically add more atoms and you get more absorption, and it's linear. So that's a straightforward place to measure the abundances relative to hydrogen, just nice and linear in the weak line regime. When the core saturates, right, that's a very saturated core. Right, so that doesn't continue to be linear, and it flattens out. There's this weird dependence, the width grows as the square root of the log of the column density. So basically, once you saturate the core, then the line is not as effective at absorbing continuum anymore. Basically done all you can do. And so there's not any extra absorption that you get from piling on more hydrogen in the core, but there is growth in the wings, so these wings get broader, so there is still some slow rise here. And then eventually the core is completely saturated and the wings dominate, and you have a different slope, growth is the square root of the column density. So as a general rule of thumb, anytime you want to measure an abundance, you kind of hope it's in the weak line regime. It's nice and linear there. This applies to stellar atmospheres. It also applies to the atmosphere of the Earth. You will sometimes hear climate skeptics say, oh, well, the carbon dioxide lines are already saturated, so it doesn't matter if we add more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. That would be true if this just became completely flat, right? If you saturated and stopped growing. But that's not true. You do add more and you do increase it some. And in fact, we're really lucky that the carbon dioxide lines are already saturated, because we're in a slow part of the growth phase instead of the linear phase. If we were still in the linear phase, we would have added 7 degrees by now, not 1.5. So there's a practical example for you. Now in stars, again, we to measure lithium, we're not able to do that at high redshift, not that I've heard of anyway. And so this measurement is usually made in the spectra of old, very metal poor stars. So again, you're looking for stars that have had as little enrichment from nucleus synthesis in stars. So you're getting back to the primordial value. And here are a bunch of stars with varying strengths of the lithium line. That depends on not just the column density of lithium, which is nicely in the weak line regime, but also on the temperature of the stellar atmosphere and the surface gravity and other physical properties that you have to work out. But we can do that. We've been doing that for the better part of a century, and we can really reasonably do good. So here are a bunch of stars, names there, their spectrum, the abundance of lithium derived from those lines, and the surface temperature of the star. So these things are all around 6,000 K. It's a little bit hotter than the sun. And the stars were selected in the first place to have a relative paucity of other metal lines. So these are metal poor stars. And when you then plot this up, this is the inferred lithium abundance as a function of the iron abundance at the ion age. I should define that. So for those of you who don't already know that silly terminology.
Put it all
it's basically the logarithmic abundance of iron to hydrogen normalized to the solar value. So this is the value in the sun. So if you go out and observe this in a different star and it has the same logarithmic abundance, the same abundance of iron as the sun, then Fe over H will be zero. So here are a bunch of solar metallicity stars. And that's just using the sun as your reference standard. So if Fe over H is positive, then you have more metals than in the sun. If it's less, you have fewer. And Fe on minus H is an order of magnitude lower abundance than the sun. That's typical in globular clusters, but it's really hard to find stars that are lower iron abundance than that. They do exist, and so those are the things that are presumptively closest to primordial. And so here's all these spectra turned into abundance measurements, and there's basically a flat level, and it's called the Speke Plateau. So basically, Speke and Speke were French astronomers who did a lot of this work, and they found that for low metallicity stars of about this temperature, then you got basically always the same answer for the lithium abundance, and that's suggestive that that is the primordial abundance. There's only a fairly narrow range of temperatures where this worked, and there are all sorts of things that can go wrong, but that's what we think. It's the best measurement we have. So you can then take this measurement, and you have the same issues with should you fit a slope or just take the average or whatever, as you did with helium. But you can do that, and here is that abundance of lithium as a function of iron over this range from Fe on H of minus 3.5, so that's over three orders of magnitude lower abundance than in the sun. That's a really metal poor star. And you can see that in the spectrum, right? Because there's just no lines in that spectrum, no absorption lines. Same thing here, there's lithium, but there's very little in the way of lines. And then all the way up to Fe on minus H of 1, which is still pretty metal poor, there's just this plateau of lithium abundances. Now, why do you reckon there's both a dotted line and a solid line? Because the solid line is what we get from other determinations. So lithium is in tension with those other elements. By that amount. It's not huge amounts, so we don't have existential crises over this, but there is a real tension. And of course, bear in mind that lithium is a little trickier. So this tension exists because this band that we're calling the right value, that's well constrained by deuterium, right? That's where those things cross. But really, the lithium abundance should be up here, not down here, if that's the right baryon density, and that's what that solid line is. Instead, it's down here, and so it's in this double bound region. It could either be that dotted line, or it could be even lower, because that's double valued, and so that would be even further off, if that were the correct place to pick. And we're just picking the high one, because that's within Halley distance of the other results. All right, so aside from this nagging lithium problem, we have a very good idea of what the baryon density is from getting all these things right. Like I say, I don't doubt that this basic picture is right, but there is some tension in what the exact value of the baryon density is. As I think I mentioned last time, there is this peculiar terminology that seems that went into and fell out of favor, but basically the parameter of merit here is the absolute baryon density, which is usually written as the density parameter in baryon, so omega b, which is this 4 or 5%, time h squared, and sometimes that's written as little omega, and the best values these days come out to be about 0.022, so 2% rather than 4%, you get from this to 4% because of that h squared, because this is a little bit less than 1, say 0.7, but then it's squared, and you move it over there, and the 0.022 becomes 0.05 or something like that, depending, of course, on what h actually is. So this quantity, the combination of omega baryon and h squared, is what's really well constrained by observations of the light isotope element abundances. H, you got to know independently of that. Okay, so that's just useful. Now, there is this other thing I worry about. As I already mentioned, the deuterium values are now up here. They used to be down here. And the timing of that corresponds to when we started getting abundances from the microwave background. And that's where the lithium attention, the lithium problem appeared. There wasn't one. If you move down a little bit to there, then deuterium was up here, and you get that number, and everything's fine. So there is a systematic in one of these determinations, and most people assume it's in lithium, but could be in deuterium too. So anyway, here's a worked example of that, what you get for the baryon density. So 4 or 5%, and I'm fairly agnostic about which, but it's clearly not nothing. We're here, and it's also clearly not 1. Right, that would have been a perhaps a more satisfactory universe if we had critical density all in normal matter. We don't live anywhere close to that. This number is much less than 1. And as I've said, this is an age-old subject. Gamow pointed it out all the way back in the 40s. By the 60s, it was well worked out. And by 1991, this was from a fairly comprehensive review work where they went through all of these elements. Here's a picture from this 1991 paper. And even at that time, they're like, oh God, okay, we've done all this, let's put it together. And it was already well established then, so this was very much a review 30 years ago. And here, like I say, is figures from that paper. Deuterium, helium 3, deuterium alone, where they found the best value, right where lithium is. And this was at the time omega B H50 squared, because a lot of us at that time believed that the Hubble constant had to be 50. So rather than using H as 1, as normal, they wrote it as H50. And this group in particular included Tram. Tram was one of the people who said it has to be 50, damn it. He was wrong. But that's why they wrote it that way. And so if you translate it into the language that most of the rest of the community uses, this means it's 0.0125 plus or minus 0.0025. So that sounds really precise, right? But that's what they said. So it's not really that there are that many digits there. It's just the choice of H that makes it so. This was so well established in the early 90s that it was just taken for granted that that was the right value. We've measured all the abundances. We've written this exhaustive review, talked about all the systematics, and that was the answer. Full stop. Craig Coppi, our own Craig Coppi, did the same thing a few years later and got a very similar answer, just saying that there was a range, omega BH squared is basically between 0.01 and 0.02. Very fussy things. At 0.02. Right, so the baryon density is just a few percent of critical. Everybody was agreed on this range. And this was an important thing to note.
you will sometimes see this written as 0.15 plus or minus 0.01, because that just splits the difference there. That is not a one sigma error bar. Craig went through all this and said, that's the range. So this was an upper limit. He did hedge, as we often do, and said, well, maybe it's more, maybe it's less. But these were the ranges with high confidence. So, you know, a baryon density of 2 or 3% rather than 4 or 5 as we have today. So this was so canonical that if you ever use a code like TNG50, I'm sure it's been fixed in there by now, but you should check if they just have this hardwired in there. The first time I started using codes like this, it was just a number that was hardwired in there, and it was wrong, so that changes things, or at least we now think it was wrong. But that's how strongly we believe we've done that part right. So that's what the value was in the early 90s, 0.0125. If we skip ahead now to the Planck value, CMB fit, which I'll describe next, that number is 0.0224. Now notice that first digit, the important one, has changed by a factor of 2. That is well outside the formal uncertainties. Okay. So there is a systematic there. And who, what, where, that's not actually clear. But this is the new standard, just as we were sure we knew that back then. People are pretty sure they know that now. And it's 0.022 something. That last digit varies with different approaches to fitting the data and so forth, but it's 0.022 something. It's a modern value. Okay. Now the neat thing about fitting the microwave background is it gives you an independent way of getting to this number. So here's all the abundances of the light elements that you give you that. This does it in some completely different way. So this is from a review by Donaldson and Hu 20 years ago, when we were just starting to be able to do this. First measurements from WMAP had just come out. And so what you're seeing now is the acoustic power spectrum as a function of inverse angular scale. And to any cosmology talk, I'm sure you've seen variations on this. And we talked about this a little bit last time with Tegmark's movies. So basically, they're showing Tegmark's movies, but as a static graph. And each line represents a different value of these different things. So how close you get to omega total for how much curvature there is. And you see the variations in omega k, the curvature, basically changes the location of the first peak. Everything else looking the same, but not perfectly. I should step back and say, what the hell does this mean? So this is the temperature fluctuation. So when you have those CMB maps, do I have one handy here? Right, so you observe a map like this, it's the entire sky mapped in temperature, with the color differences being slight deviations from the uniform temperature of 2.75K, and those fluctuations are on the scale of a part in 100,000. So it's 2.75001 versus 0.2075002, that sort of thing. So delta T is basically the difference in the temperature there to there, cold spots versus warm spots. And this is the power spectrum. So you take that map and do a Fourier transform to figure out which scales are typical. So this is the temperature difference, microkelvin, right? Tens of microkelvin, very small fluctuations from one side to the other, as a function of the inverse angle. So large angles on the sky are down here. And that's what a Fourier transform does to you, right? You get 2 pi over lambda. So if lambda is the wavelength, L is 2 pi over lambda.
So very fine angular scales are over on the right. And then the amount of power basically telling you how common a temperature difference is with that particular angular scale. And you see basically around 1 degree is where most of the power is. That's that first peak. And the location of the first peak is what's sensitive to the curvature. So it goes back and forth. You can look at dark energy, matter, baryon. So when they say matter, they mean the total mass density, including any dark matter. And when you use just baryons, you get this. So as the baryon density increases, the amplitude goes up. That just follows from the temperature squared times time is constant. You have more stuff, you make bigger fluctuations. And this is why, one of the reasons why we had to invoke dark matter in the first place was that these fluctuations were not observed to be large enough to be a purely baryonic universe. Now there were lots of other reasons to believe in dark matter, but this one in particular said you needed something that did not interact with photons, so it couldn't be normal matter. And so this total omega matter looks different, and then you get a different pattern of peaks. So when omega matter is high, there's lots of dark matter, that third peak shoots way up. Whereas if it's just baryons, you get basically a damping spectrum, so each peak is smaller than the others. So looking at that variation between the even and odd peaks tells you about the baryon fraction, what the ratio of baryons to normal matter is. Okay, so just zooming in on the baryons to compare to the actual measured Planck spectrum. So this is the best fit now. The location of the first peak is very close to 1 degree on the sky. That's where most of the power is, the most common kind of fluctuation in temperature. And that scale is sensitive to the curvature. And so that we observe it where we observe it to be is what gives us the strongest constraint that the geometry is flat in the Robertson-Walker sense. That is, if you have parallel beams of light, they will stay parallel forever. They won't diverge or converge as is possible in open or closed geometries. So that's basically smack on a flat geometry, and the limits on omega curvature are now very small, less than 0.01. But then the baryon density depends on this pattern of bumps and wiggles. So dark matter basically enhances the odd peaks, while the baryons suppress all things. This is just a damped and driven oscillator. It looks all complicated and fancy, but the baryons are provide a damping term. They're coupled to the photons. And so the photons are trying to just oscillate free. These would all have the same amplitude if there were just photons and nothing else. But because there are all these charged particles around at the time, the photons are having to drag those around, and so that leads to a damping spectrum. On the other hand, the dark matter that doesn't interact with the photons is forming potential wells, and they're not coupled to the photons. They don't interact with the electromagnetic force. So those potential wells can just grow, and the photons do whatever they want. And so the first order, there's no effect, which is why the amplitude is much lower than with baryons only. So it should have been 10 to the minus 3. If it was just baryons, it's 10 to the minus 5. So that factor of 100 in the amplitude of the fluctuations is the reasons we needed specifically non-baryonic dark matter. But how much of it, you do get a little bit of a driving term, where the baryons are a damping term, the dark matter is an effective driving term in these oscillations, because basically the photons, even though they do not interact with the dark matter directly, they are aware of the potential wells that the dark matter makes. So they're very small, but they basically get blue shifted as they fall in and red shifted as they climb out. And so the whole system is like a damped and driven oscillator. I like to think of it as a small kid being pushed by her parent on the swing, and so basically the dark matter is the parent pushing, so there's a driving term, and if the kid drags her feet, that's the damping term. And so by looking at the exact pattern of that competition between driving and damping terms, you get this really strong constraint on the baryon density. So yeah, it's 0.0224, plus or minus this ridiculous number. And one reason I think that uncertainty is ridiculous is because it's all coupled. So this is not independent of what you measure for the Hubble constant in these fits. What you fit for all the other parameters in these fits is just all one big messy covariant blob. And so the best fit for the Hubble constant from these data nowadays is 67.4. That's in tension with the measurements of local values. So that's a systematic. This is the precision, but the accuracy is still up in the air. Now, I've tried forcing it to do different Hubble constants, and if you try that exercise, you will see why, yeah, no, really, these data want it to be 67. But that's getting ahead of the story. So right now, we have the baryon density from these multiple different methods. There's the helium-4 fraction, and that has that measured abundance has a pretty wide band because it's not a sensitive baryonometer. Right, so the helium-4 abundance does change. It's zoomed way in here, right? There's a quarter. Could go from just under 0.24 to up above 0.25, but it's in there somewhere. So any of those, that range of baryon densities is fair. This particular graph uses the baryon photon ratio, that one part in a couple billion. Deuterium, we've talked about. Deuterium only allows this tiny range, right? The formal uncertainty is tiny, so it has to be right there. Helium-3, not really that useful. Lithium, which we've zoomed this in to the point where we don't see the rest of what we're talking about, but you do see that double value point. And the point is that this is very precise. The deuterium is. It's consistent with the best fit from the CMB, which is just that column. Helium's consistent with pretty much everything because its error bars are big. And the error bars are not observational so much as theoretical, just that it's a very slow-moving function. So a tiny error, observational error, corresponds to a wide range of possible baryon density. And so we've settled on this value because it fits the microwave background. It's in agreement with helium. It's in this depiction in really excellent agreement with deuterium, but it's not overlapping with lithium. So there is a tension in the lithium abundances. Do I think that's important enough to throw out the whole thing? No. I think everybody pretty much agrees with that. But I do worry about what the right value is. And I do worry that we're trusting our fits of the microwave background too much, because as I say, they're covariant with everything else. On the other hand, they really do want that value. So so most people seem to be of the opinion that this tension is just some kind of systematic error in the analysis of stars, which is of course possible. But we've sort of been stuck in that rut, and there's always a danger of confirmation bias. You have this and this, then everything else has to fall into line, doesn't it? That's basically the attitude. All right, so let's plot this up as a function of time. So now this is the baryon density, omega b h squared, as a function of when that measurement was made. And there's the compilation of all the light elements from Walker et al. That I highlighted. Right, this was already a review. That was what they said. There's the range that Kobe said right there, and that's not a one sigma error bar, as I said. That's basically, it's got to be in that range.
And then since that time, I've added on a bunch of individual measurements, and people keep doing this, so I'm sure this went out of date. I only went up to 2020, so I did it before then. But each symbol represents a different light element. There's one helium-3 measurement there. You can see it has heat terabar, so. The squares are helium-4. The yellow stars are lithium, and the red triangles are deuterium. The blue is fits to CMB. So we didn't have any CMB before 2000.
We'd measured, of course. We knew the CMB was there. We knew it had fluctuations. But it wasn't until after 2000 that we had measured the fluctuations accurately enough that we could start making these fits and constraining omega baryon. So I show you this to highlight the sort of systematics that are involved and the dangers of confirmation bias. You notice that prior to there being microwave background data, there are no numbers above 0.02.
They just, nobody found that.
That was the upper limit to what Craig said was the reasonable range. Like I said, he just said there could be unreasonable outcomes, and we live in one of those, apparently. Because after 2000, you get basically this 0.022. But look at the time evolution of this. Helium was down here. It's basically gradually walked upwards. Lithium don't care. So, you know, we keep getting the same answer there. So it's not obvious that this tension is its fault. The analysis is still pretty much stay put down here. So the most accurate claimed highest accuracy on this before the CMB was 0.019. That's those deuterium points right there. And within the errors, that's consistent with lithium, which by itself wants something a bit lower, but it's within the errors. So all that stuff is the same and consistent with pre-CMB values. Then we started getting the CMB values, and the first one was really high. That's because you have to fit all these things simultaneously, and the data still weren't up to doing that at the time, so they assumed that spectral index N equals 1. And the best fit now has that to be lower, and so that helps tilt the spectrum. So basically, N wasn't illustrated here, but N is the tilt. So you can get this. We know N is close to 1, but by making it non-1, it tilts the whole thing this way or that way.
Right. So that tips the amplitude of this peak relative to the others.
And so when that analysis was made, N was assumed to be 1, and you had to really add a lot of baryon density in order to get the second peak to be as low as it was observed. That was not expected. The position of the first peak was expected from everybody who thought the universe would be flat, and that was really a great confirmation, or at least corroboration, of lambda CDM, because up until that point, everything worked if we assumed that the universe was flat, but it was still a big assumption. And then subsequent to that, we measured the first peak, and boom, it's very flat. But the second peak was smaller than expected. If you calculate what that should be for this abundance, it would have been bigger, because there's not as much damping when there are fewer baryons. And so I remember the history of this, right? This number was down here, then we got this number, and watch deuterium. Whoop, oh yeah, we can do that. And so now they've always been above that. And that just scares the heck out of me, because it looks like confirmation bias. They didn't know about the right answer from the CMB, they got this. And once they did, they got that. And it's not like I'm saying they fudged their continuum estimates or something to get the right value. Confirmation bias is a really subtle thing. There's a whole
series of studies in psychology about that. And so it's not like you're intentionally fudging it, but if you know what the right answer is, you make choices, sometimes subconsciously, that get you in the right place. And so another thing that worries me about this is the timing, right? So you see it was basically here, and then boop, it's here. And you think about which community is doing what. The deuterium abundance is measured in high rich of quasars, which must necessarily be closely coupled to cosmology. So they were listening, paying attention to what the CMB was doing, that community was. And in fact, it's really high value. It was Chris who said, oh, we could do that, because we were all really surprised by this. And then when this came out, it was Chris who was the skeptical and said, oh, yeah, sure. Now we can do that. So maybe one has to worry about that. Since then, it's settled down and always gives you the same answer, but those are very precise. The accuracy is still in question. They've all agreed this is the answer. But in doing so, have they worked out a way of estimating the continuum or some other thing that gives you that answer? Seems like you would not have to change the continuum level very much to change that answer. Then helium. Helium is done in nearby galaxies, so that's a community of people who worries about galaxies and the astrophysics of how they work. And so they're aware that galaxies are in cosmology, but they're not as tightly coupled as a community to early universe cosmology as deuterium. And so they got the memo, but it took a lot longer for that to respond. Right. And then lithium, that's done by people who do stars. They don't care what the CMB says. They just keep getting the same answer. Now you can find in the literature examples of people who come from the CMB perspective and then analyze these data, try to make it right, and there is very clearly a confirmation in bias they're basically starting with the attitude that this is the right value. What systematic is going on in stars that made this happen? And people talk about the rotation and mixing of layers and all sorts of things. Maybe, but you really have to be careful about that. And the fact that these three different communities responded to the same result in different ways is, I worry, diagnostic of confirmation bias. Okay. All that said, it's pretty clear the number is up here, or maybe up here. It's on there, right? To illustrate how consistent this is, and I'll go back to that plot in a moment, this is now forcing the scale to go from 0 to 1. So this is no baryons. This is critical density. The same data plotted this way. And okay, you can worry about if it's 0.04 or 0.05, but it ain't 0.1, and it's certainly not 1. Okay. So how important this tension is depends on what question you're asking. So this then feeds into the budget of baryons in the universe. We think we know from Big Bang nucleosynthesis what the baryon density is. We can argue if we should have the lithium value or the deuterium value, but those are close to similar. And here is how that has changed over time. So this is the Walker et al. Value in 1991, the famous 0.0125. So that gives you a pi this big, and that error bar is the circle. So basically the area of the circle is the proportional to the baryon density. And then the inner and outer circle are the error bars on them, as stated at the time. And then there's a pie diagram in there that divides up where the different stuff is. So stars and galaxies is a pretty small fraction of the baryon density, as you've found out. Then there's the intracluster medium, baryons in the hot ICM of clusters. The circumgalactic medium, so that's a similar sort of gas around galaxies like the Milky Way. The error
big error bars on each of these wedges, which I don't know how to depict without making it completely crazy, so I haven't attempted to drive that. But bear in mind that the size of these wedges has an error bar. And then there's cold gas, the atomic gas in the disks of galaxies mostly. And all those things, the stars and gas in and around galaxies, is less than a quarter or about a quarter of the total baryons. And then out here, this is the intergalactic medium. So for a long time, we didn't really know there were a lot of baryons out there. So there was a missing baryon problem on top of the dark matter problem, because we'd only found 10%, maybe 25% of the baryons we expected from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So there was a missing baryon problem, that is, there were dark baryons out there, baryons that we expected from BBN, but we did not yet detect. Since then, most of them have been detected in the intergalactic medium. So where we live on a planet is a very dense part of the galaxy, which itself is a very dense part of the universe, and most of the normal matter is just spread out in the way great beyond. The density is super low, like 10 to the minus 5 per cubic centimeter, if I remember. There's very few atoms per cubic meter. But of course, the IGM is huge, and so you add it up, and there's a lot. So Lyman Alpha are those discrete little clouds we talked about. And then there's a warm, hot intergalactic medium, which is, rather than the Lyman Alpha line, observed from absorption in highly ionized species like oxygen 5 and oxygen 6. So again, sight lines to background sources like quasars, but you see a highly ionized species spread throughout the intergalactic medium. You got to get the ionization fraction right, and the oxygen abundance right to get that number there. So again, there are big uncertainties. But I think at this point it's pretty clear there are lots of baryons in the intergalactic medium. So that's where we were in the early 90s. In the late 90s, the size of the baryons had grown, because now we had omega B each squared equals 0.019, which is more than 0.0125. And I remember seeing that and thinking, geez, that's a lot, right? Because we'd all believe this number. 19 is bigger than 12. And you can see how much bigger by the size of the circle, right? This is not a small tweak. And the error bars had shrunk, so those inner and outer circles are now narrower. And this sort of introduced another problem. If you added up the inventory of baryons that we knew, there were still some missing. And again, I don't doubt the overall picture, but it is a question where those things reside. And the error bars on the intergalactic medium are big enough that most people figure it's probably some phase in there. You do have to worry about double counting these two populations, though. And this was all done by Mike Scholl back in 2012. I don't know if there's been a good update. But there was already a missing baryon problem way back when. That was solved by the intergalactic medium, and then it was reintroduced by the increase in the baryon density. Now you go to the Planck value for the baryon density, and again, the size of the pi grows, just the absolute baryon density is bigger. The error bars are smaller, so you can barely perceive that. And you have the same number of known reservoirs of baryons, so the fraction that is missing gets bigger. Which is another reason why I worry that, oh, maybe it's back somewhere around here and there. And this is also why you should always take error bars with a grain of salt, because you see this minimum error here encompasses all the others quite easily. There's no overlap in those error bars from one to the other. It's hard. So, you know, where those baryons might be, I don't know, but there are still baryons out there, apparently, that are dark. And so some people will talk about dark matter and sort of mess up, not be careful about whether they, well, do you mean baryons that are unseen or some entirely new form of mass? Usually the latter, but not necessarily, and people were a bit sloppy about making that distinction, so bear that in mind. Okay, so you saw this already. There's the baryon density is clearly less than 0.1 by any of these methods. Yes, I'm not sure why I did that twice. I guess so I could get the critical density in there, right? So the universe is not omega matter equals 1 in baryons. And that's been clear for a long, long time. Alright, so there are other ways where we can go out and measure the gravitating mass density, the total omega matter, and those consistently give a number larger than the baryon density. So not only is there stuff out there that's gravitating, not only are there probably some unseen baryons, but there's something out there that is gravitating that is not baryons. Unless you break omega baryon completely, you can't have that big a mass budget. So there seems to be more matter out there than meets the eye. And that's the big thing that convinced us all why there was non-baryonic dark matter in the first place. There are two basically reasons for this. By basically every evaluation method we have, and I'll talk in the future about how we did this, but we always got this baryon density was smaller than the total gravitating mass density. So there's more mass than meets the eye out there by these methods, like how galaxies stream and whatever. So you need not only dark matter, but it needs to be non-baryonic. So it needs to be from some entirely new physics, and for a long time, and probably still currently, the favorite particle was a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle, but that is something beyond the standard model of particle physics. It implies new physics, something extra going on. And this is the line of evidence that convinced most of us that that had to be true, that you just could not get up. Not only could you not get up to a density of critical density, the observed density is not critical, but it's a lot bigger than baryon density by a factor of 5 or 6. Which then is a bit of a fine tuning. Why are they anywhere near the same value? But, you know, whatever. And the other issue is the growth of structure, which we mentioned. Baryons alone should only grow by a factor of z from a Bredichev of 1,000, so that's how much growth in structure you need. But we observe that the temperature fluctuations are down by 5 orders of magnitude, not just 3. So that's the other reason you need dark matter. And not just extra mass, but extra mass that does not interact with photons. So either one of those, I think we would have, you know, back in the 80s, said, whatever. But the two of them together really convinced us that we had to have some new form of non-baryonic dark matter, and the rest is history, as they say. All right, that's a good place to stop, so we will do so. Next time we'll start talking about structure formation. And if you haven't already, go out and do your civic vote duty and vote. I will see you Thursday.